The answer is that you would have to deny the consequent in order to conclude that the antecedent is false. But notice that since the consequent is already negative, denying it will mean inserting a positive statement in step 2 and likewise for step 3. 1. If Dawn was not at the shop, then she did not witness the shooting. 2. But Dawn did witness the shooting. 3. Therefore, Dawn was at the shop. At a glance, this argument may look like the fallacy of affirming the consequent because premise 2 is positive, but it actually is a perfect instance of modus tollens. Modus tollens does not require that step 2 be negative, but rather that it deny the consequent of the conditional statement in step 1, whether that consequent is positive or negative. In short, the fallacies in question do not depend on whether step 2 is positive or negative. They depend on denying the antecedent or affirming the consequent. You need to be able to notice in an instant that these patterns of reasoning are illogical. If you do not yet see the difference between these fallacies and their brothers, modus ponens and modus tollens, make up some examples of your own and study them until you are thoroughly convinced. Reductio ad absurdum. The whole point to learning rules of inference is to be able to defend your position on one side of a debate. The rule of inference known as reductio ad absurdum is particularly useful in a direct confrontation with an opponent. By now, everyone back at the police station has heard about the murder of Cassandra, and they're all taking sides. One side, the pro-Dawn faction, insists that although Dawn did stop by the football game, she left in time to witness the shooting at the shop. This faction argues using modus ponens as follows. 1. If Dawn is telling the truth, then Mark is the killer. 2. Dawn is telling the truth. 3. Therefore, Mark is the killer. The other side, the anti-Dawn faction, insists that Mark's Moscow alibi exonerates him. They argue using modus tollens as follows. 1. If Dawn is telling the truth, then Mark is the killer. 2. Mark is not the killer. 3. Therefore, Dawn is not telling the truth. Notice that both sides agree about the first premise. Where they disagree is in the second premise, and this leads them to conflicting conclusions. This is why it is often said that one man's modus ponens is another man's modus tollens. Modus tollens is such a useful way to reverse an opponent's argument that the basic idea behind it has been expanded into a souped-up format known as reductio ad absurdum. In reductio ad absurdum, the goal is not just to reverse your opponent's argument, but to reduce it to an absurdity. Bear in mind, however, that to reduce an opponent's argument to absurdity does not mean to ridicule it. In logic, we use the term absurdity to mean impossibility. An impossibility is something that cannot be true. So if you prove your opponent's view implies an absurdity, you've refuted it. Reductio ad absurdum works by assuming for the sake of argument that the opponent's view is correct, and then proceeding to show how this very assumption leads to an impossibility. For example, the anti-Dawn faction might argue as follows, to prove Dawn is not telling the truth. 1. Suppose Dawn were telling the truth. 2. If Dawn were telling the truth, then Mark would have had to travel from Moscow to Gamerton in less than 6 hours. 3. But it is absurd to suppose that someone can travel from Moscow to Gamerton in such a short amount of time. 4. Therefore, Dawn is not telling the truth. Notice that the argument starts with a to prove line. This signals to the reader that premise 1 of the argument is actually the opponent's view. Without this step, the reader might not realize premise 1 is only being proposed for the sake of argument. Notice also the use of the counterfactual conditional in premise 2. This signals that the antecedent of the conditional is contrary to fact. It would be interesting to hear how the pro-Dawn faction would respond to this apparent absurdity. Perhaps they would use disjunctive syllogism. Disjunctive syllogism. The rule of inference known as disjunctive syllogism proposes that the issue boils down to a choice between two possibilities and then rejects one of those possibilities in order to conclude that the other must be true. Suppose the pro-Dawn faction points out that Mark could have paid the Moscow hotel clerk to say he stopped by the front desk for a newspaper at noon on July 10, even though he didn't. They then give Dawn a lie detector test that confirms her story to be true. She left the football game early and walked to Cassandra's store, where she saw Mark shoot Cassandra from 10 feet away. Armed with this evidence, the pro-Dawn faction may argue as follows. 1. Either Mark killed Cassandra, or Dawn is mistaken. 2. Dawn could not be mistaken about a man who stood just 10 feet away. 3. Therefore, Mark killed Cassandra. This rule of inference is called disjunctive syllogism, because a disjunct is an either-or statement. The symbolic representation for disjunctive syllogism is as follows. 1. Either P or Q. 2. Not Q. 3. Therefore, P. This pattern of reasoning is always valid. Notice that you could just as easily substitute not P in premise 2 and conclude with therefore Q. Unlike in the case of modus ponens and modus tollens, the order of the variables doesn't matter. Disjunctive syllogism is a handy argument form. The only problem is that it requires being able to reduce the entire issue to just two possibilities, which is often difficult to do. In this case, for example, the pro-Dawn faction had to rule out the possibility that Dawn was lying before presenting the two remaining possibilities. Of course, you can make a disjunctive syllogism with more than two disjuncts. Suppose you presented four possibilities and then proceeded to eliminate three, so you were left with just one. In theory, there is no limit to the process of elimination. In practice, however, there will always be a limit, and your opponent may complain you left the most important possibility out. This complaint amounts to a charge of the fallacy known as false dilemma, which we will examine in Chapter 4. In the case at hand, the anti-Dawn faction may argue it is not acceptable to rule out two other possibilities, that the lie detector test was faulty and that Dawn was on hallucinatory drugs. They could make their counter-argument using constructive dilemma. Constructive dilemma. The rule of inference known as constructive dilemma starts out just like disjunctive syllogism. Rather than eliminating one of the two possibilities, however, it draws implications from both and then ends with another disjunction. The anti-Dawn faction may argue as follows. 1. It could be that the lie detector test was faulty, or that Dawn was on hallucinatory drugs. 2. If the lie detector test was faulty, then Dawn could be lying. 3. If Dawn was on hallucinatory drugs, then she could be mistaken. 4. Therefore, Dawn could be lying or mistaken. This pattern of reasoning is called constructive dilemma, because it takes you from one disjunction of possibilities to another disjunction of possibilities. The symbolic representation for constructive dilemma is as follows. 1. Either P or Q. 2. If P, then R. 3. If Q, then S. 4. Therefore, either R or S. Constructive dilemma is really a combination of modus ponens and disjunctive syllogism. Rather than affirming the antecedent of one conditional, it affirms the disjunction of the antecedents of two conditionals. As you may suspect, there are many other ways of combining multiple rules of inference in a single argument. We have now examined all six of the main rules of inference used in sentential logic. Naturally, three- and four-step standard forms may not be enough to capture the nuances of an argument. We should therefore pause to demonstrate some different ways of combining them to build a more sophisticated case. Combinations. A great way to master sentential logic's rules of inference is to read and write newspaper editorials. In the broad sense of the word, a newspaper editorial might take different forms. The opinion page of a newspaper typically contains a few short articles by guest writers with special knowledge of their topic. Letters to the editor are submitted by ordinary readers, though they are selected and edited by the newspaper staff before publication. Viewpoint columns by newspaper staff columnists concern various current events. What all of these types of editorials have in common is that the author takes a position on an issue and defends it with an argument. Some of the arguments are better than others, of course, ideal fodder for up-and-coming critical thinkers. Since the dawn of the Internet age, blogging has provided another opportunity for editorializing. Most newspapers have websites with blogs. The problem with blogging is that the submissions are so informal and spontaneous that they generally don't bear serious logical evaluation. The old-fashioned editorials, in contrast, are proofread by someone and wouldn't be published if they weren't carefully considered. They contain interesting arguments while being more accessible than academic or professional writing. To write an editorial, begin by picking a topic you feel passionately about. Next, state your proposal in one clear sentence. Then list the most important reasons for your proposal. Finally, fill in the logic that connects your reasons to your proposal. Let's look at the following example. The topic: violent crime in Gamerton. The proposal: the mayor should increase police security in Gamerton. The reasons. 1. There have been 7 violent crimes in Gamerton in the past year, the highest crime rate among towns of the same size in the entire country. 2. The alcohol tax it used to pay for extra policing has been diverted to the new prison, on the false promise that the prison industry will bring economic prosperity to Gamerton. 3. It is better to prevent crime than to punish criminals, because the revenue from the prison goes to just a few bureaucrats, while security is enjoyed by everyone. The logic. 1. Either the alcohol tax should go to the police, or it should go to the prison. 2. If the alcohol tax should go to the prison, then the resulting wealth must be shared by all. 3. But the resulting wealth cannot be shared by all. 4. So the alcohol tax should not go to the prison. 5. Therefore the alcohol tax should go to the police. This argument combines 2 rules of inference: disjunctive syllogism, steps 1, 4, and 5, and modus tollens, steps 2 to 4. Now that we have our argument planned out, we can write our letter to the newspaper. Police or prison? The brutal murder of Cassandra Thomas, owner of the corner grocery on Emma Street, is yet another indictment of Gamerton's inadequate police force. Although Gamerton used to be so safe that no one bothered to lock their front doors, criminal activity has been on the rise. Last year, there were 7 violent crimes, the highest rate among small towns in the entire country. What's causing this alarming change? The local alcohol tax used to raise thousands of dollars every year to fund extra police patrolling. When Mayor Batke took office, however, he diverted this revenue to the new prison. As a result, the police force had to cut back on its services. Many people welcomed the new prison because it promised to bring economic prosperity to Gamerton, but this turns out to be a lie. Most of the employees at the prison make minimum wage, and all the profits go straight into the pockets of a few fat cat bureaucrats. This week, the mayor proposed a multi-million-dollar expansion of the original prison plan. We must stop this madness and give the alcohol tax back to the police force. Security is a precious resource enjoyed equally by all. Notice we added some interesting details that didn't appear in the standard form, and we did not spell out the steps of our reasoning. Nevertheless, the letter benefited from the careful thought we put into its logical structure. People who submit editorials to the newspaper probably don't often write out their arguments in standard form. Nevertheless, if they are effective writers, then the same logic is implicitly guiding their thought process. To see this, let's read the following editorial and reconstruct the logic behind it. Lie detector tests lie.